Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McGuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 989fm.com.au, welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company. Now, a big focus on this program in the past year has been on the important knowledges that a lot of Aboriginal nations across the country, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations, I should say, can actually bring to science. And Western science has largely been a white European endeavour, but slowly, particularly in this country, I guess they're opening themselves up, I guess, as much as they can to Indigenous knowledges. And I think we're at this point where I think Australia is slowly starting to realise just how important and sophisticated these Aboriginal knowledges are. So today my guest is someone who is passionate about promoting science and Indigenous knowledges to the next generation of Aboriginal young people. And his name's Luke Briscoe. How are you today, Luke?
Good, thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me on the program today.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. First of all, I just wanted to ask your mob and your country first.
Yeah, so I'm Cookie Yalanji, it's Far North Queensland. My granddad it was a walker in Far North Queensland, and he's like my totem, or his totem, is the crocodile, Bill Gilmore the crocodile. And so we follow his stories. He's part of a connection is part of a creation story of the Yalanji Nation.
Wow.
And that's to do with the Kitcha, talking about the formation of the moon and the earth that was first created. And then on my grandmother's side, connection is with the Wundi, the hawk that's found in the Mossman Daintree area, and her story is the Goobidi, because that's where her traditional area is. Goobidi is the story about the protector of the Yalanji Nation in the northern Yalanji region. So I've got those connections in Far North Queensland, and also acknowledge my Irish Gaelic ancestry as well. Don't really know much about that, but I think for me, being Yalanji first and foremost is important, and then learning the Gaelic background is something that'll come naturally because I'm strong in my identity.
Right. And did you grow up like that? Did you grow up knowing a lot of those really strong cultural stories?
I actually grew up in quite a closed community in Innisfail in Far North Queensland, where we got to do was just go to church and follow like a Christian religious upbringing, and it wasn't until the age of 12 where I met a Hawaiian teacher who taught us all about astronomy and looking at the stars, and every Friday night we would go over her house, all the kids, and they would talk to us about all the different formations in the stars, and from then I've just kind of created my own beliefs and connection to my own country and wanting to learn more about identity from my Yalanji culture and I did grow up in a very strong religious upbringing, which it really shapes you, I think, when you realise what you've missed throughout your childhood.
It's so interesting because I have a similar story, but I was just wondering. That's very interesting how you went out and you sort of discovered the night sky and how amazing astronomy was, because we're only starting to realise now just how phenomenal Aboriginal astronomy was in our stories. And obviously you're talking about your grandfather. How did you begin, I guess, to piece back the Aboriginal knowledge and your own traditional knowledges of the night sky?
Well, about 10 years ago, the Yalanji community started to revitalise our culture, and there was a program that my uncle ran, a cultural mapping project, where all of the young Yalanji men and women went out and, you know, learned all about, you know, the stories and, you know, and also those different song lines and those lines of stories that, you know, certain people can tell, the Moiety groups, you know, can pass on, and that, yeah, that really kind of shaped me in wanting to know all about, you know, all about those the stories that, you know, was passed on for 40,000 years, you know, through this program, and also what really was a passion for me that connected me to learning more about my language was music. So I come from a very musical family. My sisters, the Briscoe sisters, were quite prominent in the late 90s in the Indigenous music sector. Played music as well, and we came up with songs and Yalanji songs, and from there I think the connection with music really resonated, you know, with my identity and wanting to learn language, and it was fluent to learn language through music as well.
It's so amazing how interconnected it is, isn't it? Our culture, it seems quite, I just imagine before invasion, I mean, all of this spirituality, science, music all played a part together. They were all very interconnected, would you say?
Yeah, and, you know, it's no, denying that there's all, you know, sciences that's connected with it, and it's like, you know, I don't like using, you know, the word science for Indigenous science, but it's really hard, you know, to not use the word Indigenous science, because we know that it's just part of our culture. But when you're part of a group that you know, Western society devalues Indigenous science, well, I think it's important to you know, come up with theories that align with you know, or even, you know, ultimately. Seeks to find real sciences that, and when you look at some of the new sciences coming out, like biomimicry, you think about, well, biomimicry is just an idea that, you know, taken from Indigenous sciences, where
really?
Biomimicry is more about looking at how you connect with the natural environment to look at how you can integrate that into a science and a learning process through science. But we've been doing that for thousands of years. You know, it's Indigenous sciences, but they call it biomimicry.
I was just going to say, they're not going to credit Indigenous science. They're not going to call it that, are they? They're going to come up with a completely different word for it.
Exactly, yeah. So that's why it's important to have Indigenous science as a key you know, key word in, you know, in maintaining and protecting our knowledges, but yeah, it does seem like it's one of those continuing battles where, like, for Yalanji people, we would just call it Nyachikura, and that's our law, that's our dreaming, and same as, like, maybe it's in down here, it might be in Sydney, it might be like Bayami, or in Torres Straits, it might be to do with the law of Marlowe's law and stuff like that. You know, it's they're all sciences, but we just have to use those terms, like Indigenous STEM, Indigenous sciences, and just to maintain and protect it in terms of when we're writing it up. But I do think that there's a case for using our own language like Natura, when we write stuff about like song lines, we don't use the word song lines. We actually write our Natura, our lore, you know, our dreaming, you know, as opposed to song lines or Indigenous science. But I think we'll get to that stage eventually, you know, where once they acknowledge, yes, these sciences are valuable and they have to be led by Indigenous people, then that's when we start bringing in our customs, our languages, and making sure that we really embed them at the starting point of conversations with science.
It's really interesting because you mentioned it, you get a sense how important language is, really, because when you consider song lines or the word science, I mean, there's no words in English to describe what you're talking about, is there? It really describes why we have to revitalize that language to start learning our knowledges and to start promoting this form of really sophisticated Aboriginal knowledge and revitalize that.
Well, yeah, you know, I was talking to Dr. Chris Matthews, an Indigenous mathematician, and he was talking about some of these stories that are found in the paintings and how, like, Indigenous knowledges jump to quantum physics, you know, in terms of understanding, you know, the universe and like, you look at that Dark Emu book that's written by Bruce Pascoe, and it talks about gravitational waves that they've known about for 30,000 years, you know, and you think, wow, like, you know, we have all this knowledge and you know, we're just in a society that doesn't recognize, you know, that these knowledges are valuable, and when they do value them for their own use, you know, so how do we maintain and protect that for our future?
Oh, you're so right about their own use. They have to see a value in Western terms for these sort of knowledges, don't they? It's very limited the way Western society looks on this sort of knowledge.
So, yeah, that's what IndigiLab's all about, is just creating a future where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are leading in science, technology, and digital innovation. We do this through providing education, training opportunities for Indigenous communities to really revitalize and take the lead in the science space. One of the programs that's been really successful is our Ecotech program, because Ecotech, the program's all about teaching kids, youth about environmental issues and sustainability, but it's not that, you know, type of normal education that you might get through like an environmental awareness group. It's more about understanding your stories, your ancient stories and how it aligns to your environment or the environment that, you know, your community is held in, and how to look at retaining those stories, but also looking at ways that, you know, that you can make some real positive changes in your community. We ran the project, the first Ecotech program at NCIE a couple of months ago, and we had something like 11 young girls from Dubbo and Kempsey who attended the program. And the interesting thing, like when you talk about like sustainability and preparing, you know, projects and preparing like a life for future generations, they got it straight away. The kids get it. Like they get the seven generation thing straight away. They know. So, and even like they knew that like people like me, you know, who grew up in a really kind of branding, you know, in a branding kind of commercialization of commercialized world in the 80s, and like I picked up through the 80s, I picked up a lot of the of those real bad values of, you know, wanting to look at brands and you know how you continually, you know, buy brands, and a lot of that has a big impact on your carbon footprint, because it's all about commercialization and you know, just consumerism of that, and they get it, like they get that.
I guess because they're the generation that has to deal with the fallout. I mean, when you were growing up in the 80s, there wasn't as much awareness about what it was actually, the impact's going to be on the next generation, was there?
Yeah, I think you're right. Like yeah, they understand that they have to now pick up the pieces for the future, and like there's that group, the Seed Mob, who are doing an amazing, you know, role in you know, getting youth and you know, community engaged with action on climate change, which is an Indigenous-led program, and they're doing some really amazing, you know, stuff. Amelia Telford and her team, and yeah, we're wanting to partner with them to run EcoTech program as well, and we're partnering with IDX, Indigenous Digital Excellence, and NCIE as well to get out to communities and really talk about mainly the youth, because they're the, you know, the next generation, to talk about, you know, what they can do for action on climate change, and part of our role is to see how we can then embed all these different programs into some sort of curriculum where we can encourage teachers and education educators to really you know, talk about this and educate kids at school. But you know, the balance is ensuring that with the Indigenous knowledge is to ensuring that Indigenous communities are leading those discussions, and like I said, what Seed Mob are doing is perfect. There needs to be probably, you know, four or five different groups like Seed Mob out there, because you know, they're only one group, and there needs to be, you know, more. The Rangers program, you know, that's happening. That's pretty amazing as well. But yeah, there needs to be more advocacy groups out there that are working and all working in partnership together as well.
So when did you first start to get the idea of Indigilab? I mean, you're the one who really drove it. When did you sort of start to set it up?
Well, I've got a master's in digital communications and culture, and when I, you know, had done some assignments on looking at internet governance and looking at some of the real like control mechanisms of our economies, and I really, you know, really looked at in my assignments, I looked at you know, how Indigenous people can be leading in those discussions on, you know, what digital looks like in the future, and so in my mind, in Digilab was one of those kind of businesses that could take up a role where we meet with big corporate companies and work with different individual groups and organizations and community to bring people together to have a discussion and develop projects that are Indigenous led and run. And we from there, I just started really developing the idea and engaging our steering committee to look at, you know, what type of projects we can roll out and invest in. And yeah, that's really how it kind of started. Was just a kind of a need at looking at, you know, like, how do we, you know, get to sit at the head of a table, you know, with Google and Microsoft, and how do we really, you know, take a leading, you know, voice in what, you know, community and, you know, what our needs are to bring, you know, the groups together. And, yeah.
Yeah, very interesting, because you mentioned also that, and you were talking about it, I guess, before, that it really is sort of a rounder way, you know, we're sort of coming back to the start, because Aboriginal people, as you've said on the website, as a lot of people have said, we're actually looking at, the, you know, the first scientists or the first inventors. So in a way, it's a way of sort of updating that and coming back and making sure that, you know, we're still well represented in a way, because we were the first inventors, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, and when we started in DigiLab last year, it was before the innovation, the government innovation agenda started rolling out. The business, you know, fits in well with it. And when we're talking about a knowledge economy, you know, that's going to take over the mining boom. When you talk about a knowledge economy, that's kind of where, you know, InDigiLab sits as well. And it's a scary thing to think that that in a knowledge economy there isn't enough Indigenous groups like us out there. There needs to be, you know, more Indigenous focused, you know, Indigenous science focused groups that are really looking at mainly the ethical, you know, guidelines first, and looking at retaining our knowledges in a knowledge economy, because it's scary to think that in that economy that that most of, you know, what we're talking about in it is Indigenous, you know, knowledges that, you know, a connection to land and revitalization of our lands and sustainability, because
So it's almost like the mainstream is sort of coming around to what Aboriginal people have known for so long in that sense, because things are getting so bad that they're actually sort of trying to find solutions that actually sort of align with what Aboriginal people have been telling them for, you know, millennia.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, like, they're coming around, but whether or not, you know, there's rightful attributions for our knowledges, that's the most vital and important, you know, part that we all can play as, you know, in our communities to ensure that, you know, we just aren't giving our knowledges away. There was a project in Rockhampton region near there where the community negotiated with a Queensland university, I think, with utilising spinifex resin for creating bulletproof vests and stuff like that. And you think the country's like covered with 21% of spinifex, you know, around the country, and you think, well, it's not just their you know, our traditional knowledge. It crosses on various boundaries, you know. So where's the rightful attributions for that 21% of the country, if, you know, there's a patent that's gonna cover spinifex, you know, the use of spinifex resin in that area.
That's,
you know,
very interesting, because I think it was Indigenous Affairs Minister Nigel Scully, just from my memory, weren't they promoting that at the last election, that sort of new technology that was coming out? So they're actually, I think, promoting it as a win for them, I guess, for government.
It's
a form of economic development, more so. That's how it was framed, I guess.
Well, yeah, it was an economic development opportunity for that community, and I'm sure that, like, it's a good idea. But when you think about harvesting spinifex resin in a way that's for commercial use, you think you can't be good for the environment, because you're just harvesting one set of location of spinifex resin. But what about the rest of the 21% of the country? Like, I'm sure that, you know, when you do your fire burn offs and processes, you know, that look at this long-term sustainability, if you're using it for, you know, commercial use and application, there's got to be some, you know, environmental issues with that. Right. I don't know if they've looked into that, but we just, as Indigenous communities, we can't just, you know, just say, oh yeah, we're just going to take this opportunity because our mob, you know, need you know, more economic opportunities, you know, to get us from A to, you know, A to B. You know, what about the A to Z? You know, what about long-term sustainability for seven generations, you know?
It's really interesting, because it's the way sort of the mining was sort of, I guess, promoted as well, you know, as a form of economic development. And you're talking about post-mining, where we're looking at sort of selling different things or being able to build an economic base through different knowledges, and the importance we have to sort of take in ensuring that they're really protected. I know I'm just summarising exactly what you said then, but it sort of just made me, it really stresses the importance to me of actually thinking really hard about who's going to access these knowledges and how they're going to use it and whether we can trust other people and where people can go, I guess. I mean, is there a lot of different organisations like Indigilab that are sort of doing the work that you're doing?
Well, there's like the native title processes and there's all those processes that operate, to guide these, negotiations and deals with government and stuff like that. But there isn't really an ethical kind of guidelines program that could bring people together. We trialled one last year, called Indigenous STEM Ethical Guidelines, where we brought in a whole heap of different people from UNSW to Code Club Australia and local land councils, we ran this program and it was really positive. So in the future we want to start to roll out an Indigenous ethical guidelines program that not only looks at how non-Indigenous companies and government agencies what their ethical guidelines need to be, but also look at that seven generational strategies where Indigenous groups don't just make decisions on like the Spinifex resin project that only works for their own clan group. What about those other clan groups? How does that impact on them? And that's something that the native title processes don't really help. It is their right. Their right to self-determine for their communities, but what about, in terms of the environment, what about, how that impacts on the next clan group over, only a couple of kilometres down the road,
It's interesting. You've mentioned the seventh generational thing twice. Can you explain it a little bit to our listeners about what it actually means?
So the seventh generation foundational document was created in America by the Native American Inuit group, and it was really a guiding document to look at how they develop projects that are going to impact seven generations. And I've heard that the Narangiri mob they use that philosophy as well when they're planning and negotiating with their native title arrangements and with government, which is really interesting. But then, we just use those terms because they're starting to filter out and they're in policy documents. But really, what I really want to go back to is using words like Ngatjikura, where it's like, it's Yalanji law, but in terms of getting the wider concepts out there, it is a really easy kind of concept to remember.
Yeah, right.
Because Ngatjikura or Malo's law, it's very specific. But I think that's where we need to get to, is looking at, those laws like Bayami, what those laws mean in Sydney, or looking at Marlowe's law, what that means in the Torres Straits, and then looking at ways where, maybe one day we can bring elders together to look at this sustainable model that utilizes our own seven generation philosophies but at the moment, that seems to be a popular term that a lot of people are using and they get.
Yeah,
so we're
right.
Utilising that as well.
Does a lot of white Australians get it? You mentioned before that young Indigenous people seem to really understand it straight up. But are you finding that when you go out and talk to people who may not have an Indigenous mindset, that it's quite a hard concept to grasp?
Yeah. it is hard. Like I think they get it, but they just don't know, like, you know, how to start, because one, like, in Australia, it's not their land that they're on, and you know, for so many years they've dispossessed the land of Indigenous people. So how can they really understand that concept unless they go back to their Gaelic or Paleolithic kind of ancestry and look at, you know, how they can connect to an Indigenous mindset, you know, to look at, like, words that really mean, you know, like, something to them in terms of sustainability, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because the reason, I mean, that really fits into what I was going to ask you next, because I was just reading on your website that you were recently in France, for example, and there's this thing called the Worldwide Indigenous Science Network. And it's really interesting because when you talk about France, I don't immediately think of Indigenous people in France. And I was going to ask you about your own experiences there. I mean, how are they revitalizing Indigenous science in a place like France?
Yeah, so recently I went over to France to be a part of the Worldwide Indigenous Science Network team to look at the caves in France in the Gong region, and it was really interesting because the science network they've linked in with a Paleolithic expert, Pascal Rox from France, and he's had over 30 years of understanding this, and he calls himself the Paleolithic man, and he really is. Yeah, I met him, and just the conversations we had about, you know, the caves and how similar, you know, they are with stories from, you know, Yalanji beliefs. And
and
you think, wow, like he has spent his whole life, you know, devoted to understanding this. And then I also met the Occitan people over there, which was like the second wave of Indigenous kind of people in that area, but they still have you know, their mythologies that they've kept, you know, like you have the story of the werewolf, which is, you know, traditionally from that location. And I was kind of freaking out because you think, oh, is there a werewolf pop out from somewhere? But they have stories about, you know, giants living in the forest and how, you know, they're connected to those stories. And
it means a lot more
totem.
Than just a science, like a science fiction or like a popular culture sort of werewolf or a giant, you know. It means something to them, I guess. They see it differently.
Yeah, exactly. Like they, like all of the people in that area ridiculed Hollywood, you know, for fixating the importance of their totems. And the guy I met, Dominique, who's a traditional Occitan man, his totem is the bear, and he's, you know, he talked about how the bear it also has a story in the skies in terms of astronomy and you know, it's and how it's linked to his you know, daily kind of rituals, and really interesting. Like they have like smoking ceremonies and fire ceremonies, you know, before they you know, do anything cultural, and you know, that's what we do, you know, in over here. But what's interesting is that, like, it's in the heart of Western society, you know, that these ancient customs are being revitalized. I have heard that there's really big pushback from, like, the modern, you know, French idea of, you know, of what these knowledges are about in the caves. But when you go over there and meet them, like, you get a sense of, you know, their identity and connection to place and time, you know, from an Indigenous mindset, you know, in that area. Yeah, and it is really amazing, you know, to see that in France.
Well, I was just going to say, going over there, you wouldn't have expected that, would you? Because I was quite surprised when I was reading you're over in France for an Indigenous science network thing. I was like, oh, wow, I wonder what the French have. Was that surprising? You weren't expecting to encounter that?
You know, totally wasn't expecting to encounter that at all, you know, at all. You know, as far as I, you know, heard about France, it's all about baguettes and
croissants.
And croissants, you know, but it's all about, you know, the modern France. But when you go into those caves, you get a sense of, you know, such great ancient history in there, and, you know, reflecting on you know, our caves in the northern region, you know, 40,000 years old, and I think, wow, you know, like, you know, that's, you know, our indigenous knowledges in Australia are so ancient and old, and I really didn't, you know, get time to take it in. I was going over there filming as well, you know, starting to, when you're behind the camera, you don't really get like close to understanding, you know, some of those stories, because you're kind of in that world. But there was a one cave where I went to where I saw an etching of a mammoth, and when I saw the mammoth, I just had, you know, a big shock. I had to put the camera down and just had to, you know, just gasp at the mammoth that was just etched in the wall, just to think that there was, you know, that there was a human being there that etched in, you know, a mammoth that he would have seen outside the cave, you know, and that really, yeah, just resonated with me, and like a handprint that, you know, used the same technique as, you know, Aboriginal people in Australia, you know, spraying on the ochre on the walls, and then, you know, burning it, and you know, that type of experience really resonated with me, just thinking, wow, you know, there is an ancient culture here that is really undiscovered and has been abandoned, you know, for so many thousands of years because of colonialism, you know, that originated from that area, you know. It was really quite sad, actually. Like, one cave I went to, you could really sense a great kind of sadness in terms of loss of connection to the cave. A lot of the tour guide that took us through that cave, because Pascal couldn't take us through that day, he really didn't really give a like, he couldn't really see the connection with those stories, and that kind of resonated, you know, with me, thinking, oh, you know, like, that's really sad that, you know, that all these stories are there, and like the French being such a colonizer and colonized the world as Britain did, you know, it does pose the question, do they deserve, you know, to have an indigenous identity? But of course they do, you know, because it's there, and hopefully, you know, one day when, you know, when places like France really wake up you know, and grasp what it is to be, you know, or what it is to have an indigenous mind, well then, you know, that could possibly change, you know, the way Western society views the world and views nature.
That's so interesting, because I just wonder, I was just thinking as you were saying this, I wonder if white people would start to see things through an Indigenous mindset and start to value Aboriginal culture and knowledges over here more if they went to places where they're more, you know, France, England, if they have those sort of knowledges surviving in England, if they went back to their own roots and started to realise just how amazing it is, maybe they will understand the strength of it over here. I was thinking that was quite ironic, that I wonder if they went to France, they might be able to decolonise their mind in that case for themselves as well.
Yeah, and that was part of that Indigenous Science Network, was bringing over non-Indigenous people with, you know, to those places to look at how they can connect. But you imagine if there's like groups that, you know, go back over every year, you know, to understand, you know, with people like Pascal and Dominique, to understand, you know, what these stories really mean and how they're connected to those stories, not just in the caves but also outside. the caves. What you notice over there is like the mainstream kind of idea that you get a sense of the caves is that it's all about the caves, but you know, meeting Pascal and Dominic, they also get you a sense. They also give you a sense of location outside the cave and what those stories are outside and how it relates to the inside.
Right.
So the so you know, like our cultures in Australia, you know, that you have those great hills that you know tell you a story of Bilgim or the crocodile or something about an eagle, you know, and how that's connected to your, you know, totems or to your stories as well. One thing I did reflect on recently is looking at Madoc and looking at how, like, you know, how we can help white Australia connect with its indigenous mind and yeah, like looking at that, like for me, whenever I go to a NAIDOC event or, you know, organisations host NAIDOC events and they always, you know, do, you know, a shake a leg dance and get, you know, the non-Indigenous people up to dance. I think like those times are old now. I think what we need to do is if there are going to be non-Indigenous inclusion for NAIDOC, that maybe they bring something to the table. Maybe they have to learn a Gaelic, you know, dance or even Scottish dance and bring that to the table so then when they, you know, celebrate NAIDOC with us, but they're celebrating with their own Indigenous mind rather than doing a shake a leg and learning our dance, you know. So I posed the question, you know, well maybe NAIDOC you know, could be more about like for non-Indigenous people, offering something, you know, as a cultural exchange, to really think with an Indigenous mind rather than coming in, you know, and learning a shake a leg dance, which I really cringe at when I see, you know, non-Indigenous people, you know, at NAIDOC events doing shake a leg, because I know that they have, you know, their own dances and I don't know, that's just my personal belief.
I think that's got a lot of merit, you know, because I think the problem with I think that's why they can't understand the connection, a lot of Aboriginal, you know, of Aboriginal people to land and to culture, and they don't understand that is because they don't understand their own heritage. And I think it's the same you're saying about the French, they don't understand how amazing their Indigenous heritage is. And I think, you know, that's a really great way to move forward, is to get them to reflect on their own Indigenous heritages and how important that culture is, and to go back to that, and then maybe they'll start to understand just how strong it is for us as well. I think it's such a great idea. I mean, I'm just wondering how we start to promote that. I think it's just absolutely brilliant, I reckon.
But if you bring it back to what Indigenous science is all about, then in one of the articles I wrote about the Well-Wounded Sites Network, the founder and CEO, Pella Colorado, she gives an example of how important knowledges are to sustainability and humanity. She gave an example rock carving ancient sea spirit that talks about whirlpools that happen before a tsunami hits, and in the article I talk about how she reflects on this encounter she had with scientists not wanting to believe, you know, that whirlpools happened before a tsunami hits, and it wasn't until they received satellite imagery of the tsunami in Thailand and on Bali in 2011 that they realized, yeah, there are actually whirlpools.
Wow.
That happen before a tsunami strikes. So now they have to look for those warnings now in terms of satellite. If there is going to be, like, you know, mass whirlpools, you know, happening, well, you know, it's going to be a big tsunami, you know. So Indigenous knowledges are totally valuable, you know, and the amazing thing about it is like, yeah, we know that. Like, we know that our stories have great potential to sustain, you know, and also sustain life, and also build in more of a human connection to nature.
Yeah, definitely.
But imagine if the French had those stories that they could continue as well. I think for them, you know, they need to find, you know, what's the value in terms of, you know, their connection to sustainability and getting back to nature and what it means to, you know, have an Indigenous mind and look at Indigenous sciences, you know.
That's so great. I wanted to ask you as well about the symposium that's coming up, because it's in August, it's happening, they're having a big festival of science down in Sydney. Can you tell me a little bit about that symposium and what you're hoping to do with it?
So the symposium will be held on the 13th and 14th, Saturday and Sunday of August. It's the start of the National Science Week. The Indigenous Science Symposium is a partnership with the Museum of Applied Arts and Sciences in Sydney and InDigiLab. And what we aim to do with this symposium is to bring academics, theorists, researchers, designers, engineers, educators, pretty much, you know, entire Indigenous science sector, as well as non-Indigenous, but really focusing on the importance of and shaping what Indigenous science, how we can look at, you know, I suppose the richness and the leadership in our sciences, and you know what policy platforms we need to put forward, and really celebrate sciences, Indigenous sciences, and promote it. Some of the key speakers that we'll have there will include Bruce Pascoe, The Dark Dreaming, The Dark Emu, book and talking about Indigenous astronomy. We'll have Amelia Telford talking about importance of environment and science, and how, you know, we need to look at sustainable practices, and also people from the Worldwide Indigenous Science Network as well. We have a person from Timothy Brenly from a Maori guy from New Zealand, where he's going to talk about how they've included an Indigenous science agenda in their policy as well, to look at how we can look at some of their processes that they've gone through, more of like a case study. So it's going to be really a real good step to looking at how we can then create a science agenda that can really lead an Indigenous wave of scientists coming through, or looking at how we can take leadership in a knowledge economy and look at safety first of that economy. So that's happening in Sydney on the 13th and 14th, and you can go to MASS website, mass.org.au, to find more information out about that, or email marcus.hughes@mass.museum. And the costs of that are $120 per person, but there's a concession of $100 for a community to come in as well. And we just really need this discussion to start happening and create a bit of an agenda now to look at how we can retain and revitalise our Indigenous sciences.
And it's interesting because this symposium could potentially be quite important, because you're actually hoping to put together a whole heap of protocols and recommendations to sort of push that way forward. So sort of try and look at the way forward with a set of protocols you're hoping to do.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of planning at the end of the second day on looking at the protocols and developing an action agenda to put forward to the government to take up as well. I think it's such a good opportunity for anyone who's interested. We're I had this, we always talk about, you know, that if you're a black fellow, you're pretty much a scientist. You're connected to, you know, your community. You have all those knowledges. And it's just, you know, our indigenous culture is, you know, science can't be separated from it. It's all yes. one and the same, art and science. And how can you separate it, you know, when it's all
That's why
connected.
Western science has so much problem because they're always sort of in silos to the arts and to spirituality. I mean, they're all sort of kept apart from each other when in Aboriginal society it's all interconnected. So I can imagine it must be hard for a lot of scientists to grasp those sort of concepts, I guess.
Yeah, and that example that I gave earlier about Apella having to go through that experience and then realizing that her knowledges were quite vital in now planning for natural disasters is massive. There's heaps of examples out there about, I mean, fire burn-offs is another example of you know, about how you can sustain life, you know, because if you don't, you know, burn off, you know, all the, if you don't have the fire burn off, then it's going to, you know, create a natural oil that's going to, you know, keep burning. So, you know, you need to keep, you know, regenerating, you know, the cycle of the environment. And yeah, and it's only, you know, it's only really, I suppose, like in the last 10 years, Indigenous sciences are being acknowledged, you know?
Yes, very recently.
Yeah, so there are some projects like CSIRO have a partnership with the Mobbin, I think, in Alice Springs, where they look at utilising their knowledges of the stars to ensure that the crops are yielded in the you know, in the right seasons, and so they do acknowledge, like government acknowledge, that our knowledges are valuable, but you know, like at what benefit is that to our communities? It might be an economic benefit for 10 years or something, but where's the ongoing benefit from using our knowledges?
Oh, totally true. And I feel like this is the start of a broader conversation. And thank you so much for joining me on this program today, Luke. I really appreciate it and hope to get you on another time, because I feel like this is only just the start and I could have asked you a million other questions. But thank you so much. And we'll put up a lot of the details on the symposium and in DigiLab and how you can get involved on our website, 989fm.com.au. But thank you so much today.
Thanks, Amy, for having me on the program.